Hello, friends. It's the Environment Show, and welcome. The Earth Summit not only lives on, it is springing into action. An international coalition is targeting a massive forest in Russia, with global warming at issue. As the Forest for the Future initiative gets underway, we'll have the story. Also this time, a profile of Lois Gibbs, the Love Canal mother. Her citizens' action led to the passage of the Superfund Act, legislation that she says neither she nor many are proud of today.
The program is embarrassing, and I'm embarrassed because I was part of making it be.
New tactics in the fight for a cleaner environment on this edition of The Environment Show. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the national Bible of the old car hobby, monthly from Bennington, Vermont, and by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York. This is Bruce Robertson. At first, the United States refused to sign the Earth Summit Treaty on Global Warming. Not only were there objections to proposed timetables for reducing levels of global warming gases, the U.S. delegation also felt that not enough attention was given to the role of and the health of the planet's forests. Now, if we think of Earth as a sink, it is thought, to keep the sink from overflowing, so to speak, with greenhouse gases, we need to unplug the drain as well as turn off the faucet. In other words, by cutting down CO2 production, we are turning off the faucet. But by chopping down the planet's forests, we are plugging up the drain, for trees are known to absorb the primary greenhouse gas, carbon dioxide. In fact, we refer to forests as a carbon sink, a place where carbon drains out of the atmosphere. To unplug the sink, as it were, President Bush proposed that the summit establish a $1.5 billion project called Forest for the Future Initiative. Dr. Daniel Dudek, an air quality specialist with the Environmental Defense Fund, is working with a provision of FFI known as Joint Implementation, where several or more nations work together on forest preservation projects. The first phase is targeting a forested region of Russia.
This region's name is Vologda. It's about 350 miles to the northwest of Moscow. Interestingly enough, it's an area that once was the site of the infamous gulags under Stalin's reign of terror in the Soviet Union. This region is an area of so-called taiga. It's a combination of a forest wetland ecosystem, one which, once when cut, basically will not return, except with a very long passage of time, naturally back to a forested state.
The project in the Vologda forests involves government agencies in Russia, Norway, the United States, the Environmental Defense Fund, and in the United States, an as yet unnamed major utility interested in offsetting its pollution emissions. Dudek says the project will give the Russians assistance to preserve this forested region.
And they've created a national park called the Russia of the North. The park would be built, it's 150,000 hectares. A hectare is about 2.5 acres. The area has previously been logged under, part of it has been logged under orders from Moscow. This area has proven its legal capability in resisting such commands to destroy its resources. In addition, it's a unique cultural area. There are three monasteries, the oldest of which is 700 years old. It has the finest collection of icons in Russia. And so these folks are saying, gee, what we can do is we can create this combination of a natural and cultural park built around our unique local assets. What we need now is some additional investment to transform that into a real future.
The role of the foreign agents will be to finance the project to accelerate its completion. Dudek says Russia, overall, is particularly ideal for launching this Forests for the Future initiative.
The things the Russians need most now are hard currency. Their economy is in a mess. They don't yet are not benefiting from any stream of private Western investment because of these uncertainties. But this is a way of getting money flowing to the Russians helping them with their economy, and serving ourselves at the same time, not only by compensating for our emissions into the atmosphere, but also doing it in a way that has the lightest possible burden on ratepayers and on our own U.S. economy.
But more specifically, why Russia? I mean, what is particularly valuable about Russia's forests, or are we seeing this just as an economic opportunity on our part?
In terms of the forest resources of the world, Russia contains approximately 25% of the world's forests. Unlike many forest systems around the world, the Russian forests are still actively in the process of taking carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and storing it. The Russians, in their search for hard currency and investment that I mentioned earlier, are engaged in a kind of fire sale of their natural resources. They're looking for anything that they can latch onto and turn into liquid assets, hard, cold cash. One of those resources is the vast forests in Siberia and those that are equally large but not as significant in the western part of the country.
Dudek says there are active negotiations going on between the Russians and the Japanese and the Koreans to cut vast tracts of timber. Now is a critical time to act. The catalyst for this right now is the need industrialized nations have to reduce their overall pollution output. Dudek says the specific utility that will be participating here in the United States has not yet been named, but the process in general is one that many industries are already planning for.
Those far-sighted companies have developed plans, committing their companies to, in some cases, 20% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions by the year 2000. Part of their portfolio will be investments in these forest-based projects that we've been discussing. It's in their competitive interest from the standpoint of lowering the cost of meeting those targets that they've committed themselves to make sure that they have the cheapest options available. The utility industry right now is being swept by changes in competitive forces. We had also, as a part of that National Energy Policy Act, a requirement to allow access to transmission lines and the possibility of reforming the Public Utility Control Holding Act. All of this means that the local monopolies that utilities have enjoyed are breaking down. They're going to have to focus on cost and manage and reduce that cost. Essentially, these folks are positioning themselves to win the competitive race to go into the 21st century.
The argument Dudek advances is that in a broken economy such as the former Soviet Union, an invested dollar goes farther toward reforestation or other environmental remediation programs than it would here in the United States. Dudek says under provisions outlined in the new energy bill, a polluting industry may submit its reduction plan to the Energy Information Agency, which will act as a sort of bank, showing deposits in the form of pollution reductions and withdrawals in the form of continued pollution generation, the object being to maintain a healthy balance, achieving a net reduction of pollution worldwide.
As an environmentalist, I'm interested in seeing that we get the most bang for our buck. We've got to be concerned about the tension between the economy and the environment, and that means that we ought to be focusing on squeezing every last bit of pollution control out of every dollar spent.
Which raises a major argument voiced by many active environmentalists on the other side of this issue, namely that we are rushing headlong into this type of project as a way of reducing global pollution overall while not being required to change our own behavior. If we grow trees in Russia, we may be allowed to continue polluting here in the United States. That's the argument. Dudek objects.
Absolutely not. In fact, quite to the contrary. The idea of this is to show that once we can get someone to actually pay a forest owner to maintain the forest in its current state, not to cut it down, and be willing to accept in exchange money for its stored carbon value, that's a critical precedent that the foes of clear-cutting and the other forest degrading management practices in the United States can use to say, look, there are other choices beside simply whacking down these trees and destroying the habitat of endangered species. There are other choices beside legal strategies involving the Endangered Species Act and the spotted owl and the marbled murrelet as ways of protecting these forests. Let's recognize their real and legitimate value and contribution to the global ecosystem.
Dr. Daniel Dudek, an air quality specialist with the Environmental Defense Fund and one of the chief negotiators for the Forest for the Future initiative now underway in Russia. He says the participating utility here in the United States has not been named publicly yet, though he indicates one has been selected. As he says, this is cutting-edge strategy. What happens in the Volgoda region will be the proving ground for future projects. This is Bruce Robertson. Riparian areas comprise less than 1% of the western United States, yet these lush zones adjacent to streams, ponds, and lakes provide habitat for the majority of our plant and animal species. Riparian areas also help control floods, improve water quality, and stabilize stream banks. Environmental groups and ranchers have often been at odds over riparian zones, mostly because cattle are a major cause of wetland destruction. But as Becky Rumsey reports, there are signs of growing cooperation.
As far as a rancher's obligation is concerned, I think if you've got this wonderful resource, you should try to the best of your ability, to try to preserve it and enhance it.
As we became better fly fishermen, it became very obvious to us that healthy riparian habitat was very, very important to fisheries.
I think the most important is water management. Having dams operated in a way that allows the streams to maintain some dynamics.
Meeker rancher Phil Barrett, steamboat angler Bill Chase, and Boulder-based ecologist David Cooper have at least one thing in common, a concern for riparian areas. They were just three of the speakers at the Colorado Riparian Association conference this year. The four-year-old association is a coalition of landowners, resource managers, organizations, and citizens interested in protecting and restoring Colorado's riparian zones and wetlands.
We're not here to tell anyone how to manage their areas, be they public agency or private landowner. We're not here to regulate or dictate anything. All we're here to do is provide a forum for an information exchange.
Reeves Brown of the Colorado Cattlemen's Association is the current president of the Colorado Riparian Association. He hopes to foster dialogue between various interest groups with demonstration sites, tours, workshops, and a newsletter.
I don't draw the line. I don't distinguish between environmentalists and non-environmentalists. I see a distinction between people who want to solve problems and people who want to create issues.
If public lands grazing has been a divisive issue in the West, livestock management in riparian areas has become a key topic for the Colorado Riparian Association and for other similar groups propagating throughout the Rockies. Wyoming, Idaho, and New Mexico all have riparian associations in some form or stage. In Oregon, a watershed improvement coalition goes beyond information exchange by promoting restoration projects and cooperative management among agencies and landowners. When the state of Montana found that 80% of its non-point source pollution came from agricultural lands, it committed staff time to riparian education. Joan Shoemaker of Montana's Department of Natural Resources has been working with conservation districts since 1988. She says riparian management workshops draw as many as 100 Montana ranchers at a time. She believes they succeed because they focus on benefits to the landowner.
So if we can show them how it's going to cost them more money because they lose productive land because of stream bank erosion and channel widening, they lose potentially very productive forage areas that can put on lots of extra pounds, calf weaning weights. These riparian areas provide shelter that will probably increase the survivability of their calf crop. So, yeah, we really just have to translate it into dollars, and I think, you know, they'll listen.
I think one of the things that we're trying to do in Nature Conservancy is to convince livestock operators that we're not out to get them.
The Nature Conservancy's Alan Carpenter is a board member of the Colorado Riparian Association.
What really gets me going is people coming together, talking to each other in a congenial way, like realizing and admitting we don't have all the answers individually, and we probably don't have all the answers collectively. I think there is a lot of opportunities for win-win situations out there. Where I have difficulty understanding the future is how to scale up this sort of activity into the next quantum leap. How to have 1,000 people, figuratively speaking, at a meeting like this.
It's often difficult for ranchers to take time out, unpaid, to attend a meeting. This year, the Colorado Riparian Association's conference was overwhelmingly attended by agency staff. But half of the speakers were ranchers, and by 1996, the association hopes to boast that half its members are private landowners. For the High Plains News Service, I'm Becky Rumsey.
The High Plains News Service is a production of the Western Organization of Resource Councils in Billings, Montana. It all started near Niagara Falls, New York. For Lois Gibbs, Love Canal was home. It was. After toxic chemicals brought sickness to her family, Gibbs not only moved out, she organized a campaign to tell the world what was happening. Today, because of her efforts, we have the Comprehensive Environmental Response, Compensation, and Liability Act, or CERCLA, better known as the Superfund Act. Today, Gibbs lives in Virginia, far away from Love Canal, which she says is now under resettlement.
Right now, the present status is that the state and federal and local governments are trying to move people back into Love Canal. There is no community there anymore, so there isn't a whole lot of uprising. Most of the people who are struggling to fight back, and again, we're fighting politically, are pretty much from the outside now and perceived as outside agitators, even though, you know, I lived there and had a role in having it evacuated from the get-go. There are 39 families that have moved into Love Canal. Mostly in the northern end of the community, which was the least exposure levels. And, you know, we're trying to file a suit against EPA to stop it, just totally stop it.
What have those families been told about the safety of the region and what they can likely anticipate in the future?
They've been told that Love Canal is habitable. They have not been told Love Canal is safe. But the way the habitability statement is posed is that we did air, water, and soil tests at Love Canal, and we did it at these other two communities where people are presently living, and there is no difference, so therefore it's habitable. What they do not tell the people is that one community is downwind of the Occidental Petroleum Incinerator, who is the same chemical company that dumped at Love Canal, and the plume, and it was one of the suits the Attorney General office was going to bring recently. And the other one is an old oxy dump. So, you know, it's like comparing a rotten orange to a rotten orange and say both of these oranges are the same, therefore they're edible. Excuse me, I find that very bizarre and totally unscientifically. And I think the worst part of it is really not the local implications of those families. I think that's tragic. But what ultimately we believe is happening is they're trying to set residential exposure standards. If you go anywhere in this country, California, Florida, Wisconsin, and people say, what is a safe level for exposure of a family living in a home, whether it's air or water or soil, every health official will tell you, we don't know. And that's the honest truth. Once Love Canal is resettled, then the exposure levels there will become interim, which could be interim for 20 years, exposure levels. And you can see the responsible parties who make these messes coming back and saying, well, you're complaining about birth defects, as the residents at Love Canal did, and all these other problems, but the state of New York said that this level is okay, that it is a habitable area, and people are going to lose. They won't get evacuated. The cleanup costs and the magnitude of cleanup will be much less than it needs to be. And responsible parties will not pay personal injury suits. And so all of the corporations win and all of the people lose.
Love Canal, in a sense, was the first Superfund site. Lois Gibbs was the first to fight such a condition. At first, with the signing of the legislation in 1980, there was much hope. Today, though, Gibbs says most agree.
The program is embarrassing, and I'm embarrassed because I was part of making it be. Originally, the way it was designed, they were supposed to go in and clean up these sites and protect public health and our resources, our drinking water supply and our air, and then go after the responsible parties to clean it up. Unfortunately, since it's been enacted in 1980, and maybe it has to do with our Republican office since 1980, but since it's been enacted in 1980, there has been very few cleanups. It's almost all lawyers first. And the way they figure out what needs to be cleaned up is they sit down with the responsible parties, those who are going to pay for the cleanup, and they say, how much do you want to spend? How much will you spend? Almost every case, if you look at across the country, comes to $20 million or less. Then EPA comes back and says, okay, what can we do for $20 million? And then they'll lay out three options. And it's not all of the options available for cleaning that up. It's not all the options available to protect public health or our natural resources. It is the only options that are available within that dollar amount. And that's what's wrong with the program. So you never get an adequate cleanup of these sites. You definitely don't get permanent cleanup of these sites. And the corporations, again, have the power and the control and get off the hook very, very easily.
Today, Gibbs is founder and executive director of the Citizens Clearinghouse for Hazardous Waste. Her main campaign is to reduce what is going into the pipeline, reduce what we generate in order to reduce what we have to throw away. She has a twofold plan.
One is what we call very crudely plugging up the toilet. If we take away, we believe, the inexpensive disposal methods, which is burying it and burning it in massive amounts in central locations, then industry, if they don't have a cheap place to dispose of their waste, will begin to deal with it at the plant site. Right now, it's cheaper to even truck it all the way to Alabama than it is to reduce it, because it's just so inexpensive to dispose of there. So if we stop these facilities from going in, and there's only a few facilities left, and those facilities, knowing there are only a few of them left, will charge an arm and a leg for every ton deposited there. And what we're hoping the discussion will result in the boardroom with the board members saying, gee, Joe, we used to pay X for waste disposal. Now we're paying Y. How can we cut those costs? What can we do? And I think unless we affect those corporate balance sheets, that we'll never get serious source reduction and elimination in this country.
The other target, says Gibbs, is actual products. Citizens Clearinghouse led the successful campaign against McDonald's and other fast food restaurants to eliminate the use of foam. Lois Gibbs, the Love Canal mother who discovered in 1978 that her children were attending a school built atop a toxic waste dump, that they were getting sick, and though very shy, she says she was motivated to organize out of fear that her children were going to die.
What it really means, I mean, I had a high school education, extremely shy, no political experience before. But what that says to the world is that, my goodness, if I could do it, and I'm nothing special, I'm really not any different than anybody else out there. If I can do it, then other folks can do it. And what that means, you know, I can remember for years sitting back, my father saying, oh, we can't change it, we can't fight City Hall, you know, there's no point in. And I can remember those words and the feeling of having no power. And what I found, quite by accident, is that we really do have power. We have incredible power.
Lois Gibbs, she says we can and need to get involved and get organized, not necessarily on environmental issues either. Go to a school board meeting, anything. You will be surprised and gratified to feel a sense of power and influence just by participating. This is Bruce Robertson. And that's our report on The Environment Show this week. The Environment Show is a program about the environment, the air, water, soil, wildlife, and people of our common habitat. If you'd like a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-767-1929. Ask for The Environment Show, program number 154. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, solely responsible for its content. Dr. Alan Chartok, executive producer, and this is Bruce Robertson. The Environment Show is made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York and by Hemmings Motor News, the national Bible of the old car hobby, monthly from Bennington, Vermont.